A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. Wishing everyone a peaceful Christmas and looking forward to seeing you all again in 2021.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, this is Ed Finn and you're very welcome to A Taste of Ireland. My guest this evening is truly a living legend, a well-known musician, radio host, author, and indeed a colleague here on Sunshine. Paddy Cole, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ed. What a glowing introduction. You know, that's great. Thanks. Great to be here with you.
Paddy, you're looking fantastic.
Well, Ed, now, there are three stages of ageing. Young, middle-aged, and you're looking fantastic. So,
oh, that makes a lot of sense.
I had to pull you up there.
Paddy, I'm having great fun at the moment reading your new book, King of the Swingers. And I must say, it's not just a brilliant book about you and your life and the stories, but it's almost a history lesson as well. It's just fascinating stuff.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you made that. Tom Gilmore that wrote the book, actually, and he would talk to me when I was cocooning. But he has described it the same way as you now. He has said it's like a history lesson about Ireland moving from the 50s, the gloomy times, right through the showband days, brightened everything up, and suddenly people were even dressing brighter. And whereas before that, even the bands sitting down, like when I started off, you're sitting down reading music, and most of the time it was a dress suit and a dicky bow. And then suddenly bands like the Clipper Carlton and the Royal Showman, they came along, bright blue suits and crew cuts, real American boys, and the whole thing was revolutionised straight away overnight. And then we were all in on that thing.
And in fact, this isn't your first book. I mean, I love the title of your other book, Tell Roy Rogers I'm Not In.
Well, Tim Ryan did that book, and that was about 37 or 38 years ago. And Tim Ryan had heard the story. When I was living in Vegas, Kevin Marne, the late Kevin Marne, Lord Mercy, who died tragically on that plane crash when they were going for the wine, bringing the wine back. And Kevin was a great friend of mine. He was from Dundalk. And Helen had invited him up to dinner in her apartment one evening when we were there. And I'd been hanging out with Roy Rogers. Roy was there doing a movie, a modern day movie. Trigger was long dead at that stage. And he was in a pickup truck, you know, instead of Trigger. And then when I was coming out the stage door, there was a bar there, and Roy would be standing there every night waiting on me. And then we go along, and at the beginning it was a great novel. He was telling me about trying to get the fourpence to go to see him when I was a young friend, Cassiplaney and all. Great crack. And a very wealthy man, one of the wealthiest men in California, but a very lonesome guy. But when the phone rang, I said to Helen, if that's Roy Rogers, tell him I'm not here. And Kevin Marne, of course, fell off the seat with the laughing. Now, different guys have embellished that. Like they've said, if that's Roy Rogers, tell him to do what to do with himself, you know, but which I never, I just said. So Kevin Marne then, having said that, his funeral was in the cathedral in Dundalk, and it was so crowded that I couldn't even get into the cathedral. It was outside. Father Brian D'Arcy was saying the Mass, and suddenly there's this big roar of laughter goes up inside, and Father Brian had told the story, what happened. And then Tim Ryan decided, against everybody's better judgment, that he called the book Tell Roy Rogers I'm Not Here. And nobody knew that it was my book at all.
Oh, that's brilliant. Paddy, you came from an incredible musical family. I mean, you were born practically with the saxophone in your mouth, really, weren't you? I mean, the story is fascinating.
My father was a sax player. He was the first man to bring a saxophone into Monaghan. And he was self-taught. He was a great patient man. Self-taught, sent to Selmers in England for tutors' books so as he could go through the whole thing, and he was self-taught. And then when I was about 7 or 8, he started me blowing the sax. Now I have to say, at the beginning I hated it, because when I came home from school I could hear the boys playing football outside, and I had to be there going through this tutor. And that evening when he came back in, he worked in the post office, drove the mail van, and as well as playing in a dance orchestra. And when he came in the evening, anyway, I had to be able to play the piece with him. And then I started listening to some of his LPs, we called them at the time, long playing records on the old gramophone. And it was all big band, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and then some Dixieland jazz from New Orleans. And I just developed a love for that sort of music, and that made me practice and practice away. And that's how I started. But I was lucky enough, Coles had a band, like my father's brothers and a cousin of mine played trumpet with them and all that. So there was a lot of music involved in the family there.
And of course, those times as well, they were tough times. I mean, and you were right on the border where you lived there. So that was, it was an interesting location that you were in and the influences that you had there.
Yeah, it was only a couple of miles from the border. And of course, everybody used the border in those days. We just thought it was a natural thing. If something was cheap on the other side of the border, you went across and bought it and you smuggled it back over. And we thought we were high-class smugglers, but we were only small-time. We'd go to Cross Madeleine and we'd get maybe 6 white loaves because the bread was very bad after the war down south. And we'd get 6 white loaves, and paraffin oil was scarce in the south. So you'd get in a paraffin oil and 6 white loaves, and so you thought you were like the Godfather coming back down the road. and the customs men knew what was going on. But they were after the bigger fish, the guys that were smuggling lorry loads of pigs and all that sort of stuff, you know.
Over the years, what you've seen and the changes, I mean, it's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. And where we lived, Ed, the customs post was right across the road.
Yeah.
So 5 o'clock in the morning, we might be waking with the squealing of pigs in a lorry right outside the door that were after being caught crossing the border. And we got to just accept that. We knew like that, it's a smuggler caught, you know. The smugglers in those days were like heroes to us. You know, like there was one story that happened one time. This particular well-known smuggler, and he was in a pub in Castleblaney, and the customs officers came in and said, "We have you." He had a load of butter in the car outside. And he said, "Oh, you have me, all hands up, you didn't, I admit everything. I just want to get something out of the car." And he went out, he pressed the button in the car, and the car went on fire. And the butter went on fire, and the butter was flowing.
James Bond
flowing,
stuff.
Yeah, the butter was flowing down the street in Mucknow Street on fire. And all the places were scorched the whole way.
It became a room.
So, of course, he was like a hero to all the youngsters, you know.
Oh, my God, that's fascinating. I mean, yeah. It was all set up. There was no big getting caught. Brilliant. Butter, paraffin and white bread. A great mix.
All the essentials, yeah.
And, Paddy, I mean, you're a showband legend. I mean, of course, people are fascinated by the showband era here in Ireland. And, I mean, you played extensively all across Northern Ireland and here as well. I mean, it must have been so interesting for you.
Oh, it was. And in those days, there was no dancing during Lent in the south, and there was dancing in the north. So every little paraffin oil shed in the north opened up for Lent, and there were dances all over the place. Parochial halls, the priests made a fortune at that time in the north. But there was a famous story about a musician in Cork that played in a resident orchestra. And at the beginning of Lent every year, he arrived up to the bishop's palace with his 4 or 5 kids, and demanded to know how he was going to feed the kids for the next 7 weeks. And, like, I thought that guy had great courage and great guts in those days, like, you know, like the church was really controlling a lot of the things in Ireland, you know. And, yeah, we played all over the north of Ireland. And in actual fact, like, growing up so close to the border, you knew there was a difference. You knew, like, that the British Army were there, that the RUC sort of weren't our side, if you know what I mean. And But there was no, like, we played football with Protestant chaps, and the only thing which was unfortunate, Ed, when it came to a certain age, they were going to a different school, which I thought was sad, because then you suddenly, that did instill in you, well, there's something different between us, you know. And it was just the system, and it was sad. I thought, like, we had great buddies, great friends, you know, that we played football with and everything. And then they were the same. They were going to a different school and we were going to a different school.
Music really is a great leveller, isn't it? Because people just loved your music, and religion didn't matter, really.
It didn't come into it. And in actual fact, I remember one time we were stopped, years later, we were stopped in the north with the Capital Show Band, and the UDR, and we used to be afraid when they would stop us late at night coming home, but the UDR stopped us, and there was a definite smell of drink from these guys and everything, and they said, "What's your religion?" And I took exception to this, and he said, "Are you a Catholic?" And I said, "Yes." We were coming from after playing in a parochial hall in Tyrone, and I said, "I am, yes." And one of the guys in the band, when they went along the line, much to her all her amazement, said, "Well, not that it matters, but I am a Protestant." That was the first we knew that he was a Protestant.
Yeah.
You know, like, it didn't enter into it, as you said, like, with the music. And the same with the audiences.
Well, I presume when you were auditioning for band members, you were pretty worried about what religion they were.
No Catholics need to play and all that.
And there was a great story in the book as well, I loved, about you were playing for some audience and someone asked you, was it that they said to you they were mixed?
Yeah, Sammy Barr up in Ballymena. And Ballymena was a very orange sort of
Liam Neeson territory.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And Liam was a Catholic, and when he played the part of Michael Collins that time, he got a lot of stick up that part of the country for playing the part. But a great actor. And I knew his mother well, Kitty. But Sammy was a great character.
Yeah, and they said it was the crowd mixed.
He said to Brian Call, he said, "Lord of mercy," he said to Brian, "always remember that this is a mixed crowd." And Brian said, "Yeah, the whole crowd is Protestant and the band is Catholic."
And a great night was had by all, I imagine. Okay. The Capital Show Band, of course, we'll touch on that now as well. And I mean, the stories are fantastic. That brings us along very nicely to your first choice of music this evening. Now, we're in the festive season, Paddy, you know. Blue Christmas, Paddy, lovely choice.
Yeah, Elvis Presley. And of course, Elvis Presley was a big influence on us all. Back in the early days when he came on the scene, he revolutionized everything as well, the type of singing and the rock and roll. He was responsible, if you like, for Brendan Boyer starting doing the Elvis Presley medleys and the Royal Show Band, even in the late 50s and the mid to late 50s. And Elvis was a huge star. And subsequently, which we'll talk about maybe later, I had the great pleasure of meeting him a few times in Vegas and all that, which was a great thrill to meet him after all that. But yeah, I'd like Blue Christmas because, as you said, it's the festive season and Elvis Presley.
I'll have a blue
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. Wishing everyone a peaceful Christmas and looking forward to seeing you all again in 2021.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
You're listening to A Taste of Ireland with my special guest this evening, the King of Swingers himself, Paddy Cole. That was a lovely song, Paddy. You loved it.
Yeah, Elvis Presley, like I said, brings back so many memories, and Blue Christmas have been the festive season.
Absolutely.
And even though we'll all be sort of in semi-lockdown, no gigs. God, at this time of year, we used to be doing loads of gigs before Christmas and everything. And George Hunter had a load of gigs lined up for me before Christmas. Concerts, you know, which, needless to say, they're all put on hold.
The Elvis stories are great in the book as well. Now, there's great stories about Elvis going along to see you. He was a fan and everything.
Brendan Boyer, of course, as everyone in Ireland knows, used to do a tribute to Elvis. And he did a whole medley of Elvis Presley songs, all his earlier ones. And one of them was One Night With You, which Brendan would go down on his knees on the stage and sing this. And the crowd used to be cheering. There'd be about 700 or 800 in this room we were in, you know. And this night, Brendan's down on his knees, quite close to the edge of the stage. And this guy walks up with a cloak, like a Sandyman Port sort of outfit, and the hat and the cloak and a wand. And he tapped Brendan on the shoulder with the wand. And Brendan looked up, and it was Elvis. And then he just turned and walked out. And Brendan shouted, "That was Elvis Presley." And everybody started to laugh and clap. They thought it was part of the act. They didn't believe it was Elvis. So Elvis was in, did it, and was gone. And when we were in the dressing room with Elvis, the next time we were in the dressing room with him, it was in Caesar's Palace, and he mentioned the thing, and we laughed. We had a great laugh. But I think Brendan was... Elvis at that time was superbly fit. The dressing room was done out with rowing machines, bicycles, weights, all the things that you and I would be avoiding, Ed, you know what I mean? so he said to Brendan... and Brendan wasn't too pleased. He said to Brendan, "Are you still doing all that old shit?" And Brendan said to me, "What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? They were his best songs. What do you mean by that?" "I don't be taking it so seriously," I said. He didn't mean. And Presley was in bits laughing when he saw Brendan, the way Brendan reacted to that, you know.
Then it was brilliant. Sad
to see Elvis towards the end of his days when he had put on all this weight and he was all... There was a Dr. Ganem who was a friend of ours, personal friend of ours there, and he used to have to sit at the side of the stage every night at in Elvis's later days in case anything would happen to him while he was on stage. Oh, it was very sad to
see. It. Sad, it is very sad, isn't it?
I mean, the way it went.
The most amazing voice. But Paddy, your the part in the book there, Sin City, and about Vegas, I mean, that is absolutely fascinating. Tell us a little bit about when you went there and how long you stayed there and what happened.
Yeah, well we went there, we stayed for about 7 or 8 months doing the Stardust Hotel. And a lot of people would say the gigs were tough. We were doing 3-hour-long shows every night, 6 nights a week. And the first show might be from 8 to 9, the next show might be from 10 to 11, and the last show might be from 12:30 to 1:30. So you were there all evening. But at that stage, we were a lot younger, and there was a continuous list of shows on. You know, like when we'd finish, it was a revolving bandstand, as a fella at home used to call it, a revolting bandstand. And it used to be going around, and another act would be on straight away. There was a fabulous act, the Bare Touch of Vegas, all topless girls, dancers, and great singers, and a great band and everything. And in actual fact, one of the members of the band, he played saxophone, was Lee Greenwood, who went on later on to be a superstar himself, when he sang The Wind Beneath My Wings and all that. And he came back as a headliner to Vegas. But anyway, that's by the way. We at that time, when the planes arrived to Vegas, the pilots were instructed to flew along the strip before they landed. So you're looking down at this mass of lights. We could not believe it. I couldn't believe it. Now, Brendan and Tom and those have been there before, but the rest of us in the band, we couldn't believe it. And then our job, we were there for 2 weeks. We were rehearsing, and then we were getting accommodation ready for the wives and children coming over. But it was something different, because the fact that you were there for the 7 or 8 months, you met all the superstars all the time, and you became a kind of complacent about it, if you like. Not big-headed now, but the fact. Like one day, Mickey O'Neill, our drummer, said to me, for a bit of exercise, you want to hit a few tennis balls. And when we went over to the tennis court, Andy Williams and Sidney Poitier were playing tennis. Do you know what I mean? And we just didn't pass any remarks on that. And even when we met Elvis a few times in the dressing room with him and everything, there were no mobile phones or selfies or anything, and none of us had cameras. And you'd always say, I will get a photograph the next time. But the next time, you see, didn't come around.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, God, the Andy Williams show, do you remember that ran and ran? God. My mother used to absolutely love the Big Bear.
Yeah, and the sweaters, the different selection of sweaters. And we got a terrible surprise, you know, because he was very small.
Yeah,
Not that it meant took away from his voice, but we couldn't believe it, like when we saw how small a guy he was, you know, but a powerful voice, great singer.
Of course, that time it was the playground, wasn't it, for the rich. And unreal. Those years, Paddy, I mean, just for people listening, again, that kind of ear talking about
there. That was in the
70s. Yeah, the 70s, yeah. So.
And like our next door neighbour was a guy called Andy Anka, who was Paul Anka's father.
Oh, yeah.
And he used to bring my kids to Paul Anka's kids' birthday parties. And another thing that we only think about later, little things like that, you know.
Yeah.
And like you said, you'd be walking, the bosses in the Stardust would get complimentary tickets for us for any show on the strip. And you'd always try to pick, like on a Tuesday night or night off, maybe a good one if Sinatra was on in Caesar's Palace or something. One of the best shows I ever saw, Ed, Sinatra didn't show up. He was in dispute with Caesar's Palace, and the place was dark for a week. In other words, no show on. The bosses were going bananas because the shows were only a means to draw the people in, and then the people would gamble. So the next time Sinatra was booked to come back, in case he might get temperamental, they booked the Count Basie Band and Ella Fitzgerald, and Sinatra showed up.
Wow.
There we are sitting. I thought it was in heaven. The Count Basie Band and all those musicians that I listened to all my life, Lady Ella came out and wrapped it up. And then Sinatra comes out. And then Ella Fitzgerald himself did a couple of duets. Oh, that was just an unreal show.
Wow.
And then late at night, we used to go to see Louis Prima. All the acts on the strip would go to see Louis Prima. He was the zaniest character of all time. Trumpet player, Italian-American, came from New Orleans, born in New Orleans, so a big jazz influence on him. But he was as mad as 10 hatters, and he didn't care what he did on stage. And we all loved him. And you would see all the acts, all the top acts on the strip would be in there to see Louis Prima for his last show at night. He was something else. And he used to split up the band a lot because he had a habit of marrying the girl singer quite often. And
as you do.
Yeah, as you do. And then, of course, when that would split up, the girl singer would leave the band. But Keely Smith was the last lady singer that he married in the band. But things weren't going well with them, but they didn't split up, and Keely was still in the band. And during the act, Louis would look over and say, "Yeah, yeah, yeah," and she would give him a complete deadener, and he'd roll his eyes out to the crowd, you know, and everybody knew his personal life, you know.
Oh, brilliant. That's a fabulous story. In fact, you were saying Ella, I actually remember, I was very young, I saw Ella Fitzgerald in the Cork Opera House. Would you believe that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and you played the Cork Jazz Festival.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of their bigger, I mean, that was just incredible. I remember George Melly was, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I remember it's like Anne Bushnell, yourself. There was, you know, it was one of the big ones over the years.
Cork was wonderful.
Back to the sort of the late 80s, early 90s now.
Wonderful.
After Vegas then, I mean, that was to be, it was like another world. Did you miss Ireland?
Helen and myself had never intended to stay there. We always knew we would do it for a certain length of time and that we would come home. Whereas most of the other people in the band all had intended to stay there, as Brendan did right up until he died there. But we were at home, not realising. We still had a lot of stuff over there, a car and stuff like that we would take out of the apartment when we'd be coming home. And I was sitting having a mug of tea with Helen one day and we started talking about it. And I said, you know, Helen, I think we should stay at home. And she was thrilled. She blessed herself, actually. I said, God, was it that bad? And she said, it was your job. And she was very supportive always. And she said, it was your job. And was gone. But she missed the seasons. Daffodils coming up.
Yeah.
Things like that. You never saw, everything was the same the whole year round there. You know, hot, heat, heat, heat. And so we decided to stay at home. I had no gig. I had nothing going. And Tony Lockman and Casablanca heard that I was thinking about staying home. Now, Twink had left the Big Eight at that stage. And he sent a friend of his, Dickie Sullivan, and a friend of mine to find out if he wanted, in other words, to form a band, a Paddy Cole band. He was managing country and western bands, Susan McCann, Philomena Begley, Big Tom at that time, and a lot of country acts, but he wanted a poppy band doing middle of the road stuff and that. And he figured, so that's how the Paddy Cole Superstars was formed. And when I said that I was staying at home, Twink was still here, and Tony went and convinced her to join the band, which I was thrilled about. And then Jimmy Conway, Mickey O'Neill and Michael Keane, the three of those stayed as well. They decided to stay in Ireland and they joined the band with me. Now, subsequently, they went back to Vegas. And I understood that, you know, the old lure was there for them to still do it. And then when they wanted to come back home, it was too late kind of to come back home. You know, the scene had moved on and different things like that. Now, I still keep in touch with Jimmy Conway in Vegas, and Mickey died, Lord rest him, as well, some years back. But that was their decision. My decision was to stay at home, but I was glad about that. When Tom Dunphy was killed, Frank McLoon, who was a great friend of mine, he ran the Tara Street Ballroom, and he ran all the halls for John Bourne all over England and Scotland. He phoned me to say that TJ Bourne, the accountant, and Brenda Boyer and wanted to meet me in the Gresham in Dublin. I was living in Casablanca. I came up to meet them, and it was to see if I'd go back in to the Big Eight as band leader. And I said, no. Tony Lockman had put this band on the road. He put a lot of money into it, different things. And I said, no, I couldn't really let him down. And then they said, well, you haven't really heard what the offer is. And genuinely, I said, don't tell me, please, because in the middle of winter, I'll be setting up equipment in some freezing hall somewhere and I'll be saying I could have been in Vegas. Plus the fact you can never say that I spoke about what you offered me. you know.
Very good.
So
yeah.
I never ever talked to him, but there was no animosity. There's no, we all remain great friends, like, you know.
Now, your second choice of music this evening is this great character you spoke about
Louis
earlier.
Prima. Yeah, Louis Prima. And I'm delighted to be able to play Louis Prima. Don Long and the Capital Showband used to do this number with us, and that was the first time I ever heard of Louis Prima, when Don Long used to do it. And it was a showstopper for us. The name of it is Angelina.
I eat antipasto twice just because she is so nice, Angelina. Angelina, waitress at the pizzeria.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. Wishing everyone a peaceful Christmas and looking forward to seeing you all again in 2021.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, you're listening to A Taste of Ireland, and I hope that you're all having a lovely Christmas. My special guest this evening, living legend, music royalty, Paddy Cole. How are you, Paddy? Welcome back.
Thanks, Ed. Thank you.
That was another fabulous song, Louis Prima. That brings me back. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
Me too. Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic.
And Paddy, so when you came back to Ireland then, you were working at, you worked in the Harcourt Hotel, of course, for years. You were, your jazz sessions there were famous.
Yeah, we did the jazz in the Harcourt for a bit. Brian McGill, that owns the Harcourt, and his son Barney now. And Brian got on to me and asked me to do a jazz gig for 4 or 5 weeks and see if I liked it or what would happen. And we finished up doing it for about 10 years. It was a wonderful setup, a great place to be. Every Sunday night it was packed out. And people still say to me, oh, I met my wife at the Harcourt at your gig on the Sunday night. And I say, don't blame me. But it's like... But no, it was wonderful. And then there was a lady, Lord rest her, she's dead since, Marjorie Courtney. And Marjorie was doing the booking for all the corporate work in Dublin at that time. She was the booking agent, and she gave us a lot of work. She gave us a lot of work. She was giving a lot of work to all the entertainers, but she gave me with the band a lot of work. So we started doing an awful lot of corporate work for companies, dinner dances, weddings, all that. So we did lots of weddings, and the band was very busy. We were very busy, and it was, the band was doing well. And that was after I had been in Casablanca. I had moved back to Casablanca and was running the pub there and playing with the Paddy Cole Superstars. But then subsequently we decided we moved back to Dublin. And Pierce and Pat and Karen were all in college in Dublin. I was only Helen and myself. And we said, look it, let's move. And we moved back to Dublin. It was a great move. We're delighted. And it was a happy time that time and a busy time for us. And a lot of good things happened. Like I got the Hall of Fame Award on a television show from the concert hall. And Michael Flatley presented the award to me that night. And there were a lot of little things like that happened that were nice. Like going to New Orleans with my own band was wonderful. And there's a photograph in the book of me standing outside the jazz club and the poster behind me, tonight, Paddy Cole. And I don't mean in a big head of way, but that I get a great buzz when I see that, because to me, New Orleans was the mecca. It was the place that jazz started, which was true. And this was the place I wanted to play. And Sean Griffin ran the first couple of trips, and then Sean Skehan ran another couple of trips after that. So they were all great, and loads of people went on them. And we were supposed to go on a trip, and the terrible storm Katrina hit Las Vegas, or hit New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
And we never went. And I'm still in touch with a lot of the musicians there. A fellow called Jimmy LaRocca. And I used to collect records of his dad. Nick LaRocca had the original Dixieland Jazz Band. And Jimmy was a brilliant trumpet player, and he used to sit in with us when we go over there, and it was wonderful like that. You got to be playing with great musicians.
Going through the book from Muhammad Ali to, I mean, Elvis, isn't it amazing how, I mean, the journey you've had with music, that you've met everybody that you can think of. It's, the pictures in the book are fascinating.
Yes, and travelled all over the world, Ed. Mm. And Helen and myself might be sitting at home on an evening watching a movie, and it might be about Jamaica. And I'd say, do you remember the time we went to Jamaica with the band, telling the whole lot, it was wonderful. We'd have memories, we'd talk about that. Or the Middle East, Qatar, Doha, all those places we played with the band. And then of course, America and New Orleans, especially Vegas, Canada. We did lots of tours in Canada as well. And my oldest son, Pierce, is now living in Canada. Well, he's away out in a place called Calgary. But we used to go to Toronto a lot. Even when the Big Eight had a few weeks off one time in Vegas, I got in touch with the guy that owned the ballroom in Toronto. And we went up and did a couple of weeks there for him, concerts and dances. And yeah, I look at things now and I look back and I do say, Paddy, you were a very lucky man. Thank God for your dad. And I say in my dedication, I dedicate the book to my father. And I say, he, at one part of it, I say, he was my hero. I'm sorry I never told him.
Oh.
And because in those days, you just didn't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you didn't hug your father.
No, I know absolutely. I mean? Yeah,
and
yeah.
But my sisters go into tears. Oh, he knew it.
Stop,
he
you're making me. I'm Philip. I don't think I hugged my dad when I was about 18.
And like, it's wonderful because my son, Pat, that lives beside me now, I'd meet him for a coffee, maybe in Mimas or Morton's or around that area. And first thing Pat does when he comes is throws his arm around me, you know, like, and that's wonderful.
That's something that we're all dying to get back to.
Exactly. Like,
once we're all vaccinated, we can be hugging each other to death.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a funny thing. I meet Pat and his wife, Ger, and their family. They have three girls and a boy. And we meet in Herbert Park and we stay at a safe distance. Mm. But if one of the days I was wandering a little bit close to Jamie Kate, one of my granddaughters, and she just started singing the Police song. Don't stand so close to me. She started singing the song to me.
Brilliant. Oh my God. A subtle way of saying back off now. That's gas. There's a lovely little story in the book as well about, I mean, going back to those times there when, you know, times were hard, when you wanted to get a fabulous little piece for your saxophone. You were saying, I think your dad was earning about a fiver a week at the time. And you were going over, you used to go over and back with a friend of yours, and your mum put the fiver into your hand.
That's
when
right.
you, I mean, I thought that was so touching and such a lovely story.
And to this day,
the support you had
you'd
there.
You'd wonder, like, where did my mother get the fiver? This was always in my mind, always after. Like, I mean, because things were very tough. My dad was working two jobs, as you know. I had six sisters and myself, big family to look after. And we were going to Matchett's in Belfast, a music shop, and I saw this Brillhart mouthpiece and I couldn't afford it. And the next time I was going up, Morris Lynch to collect something, and my mother slipped me the fiver to buy the mouthpiece. To this day, I do not know where the fiver came from. Unreal.
We can't finish up without chatting about your charity work. You've done incredible work, Paddy, and raised a serious amount of money for charities over the years.
Yeah, I'd have to say that the people in the music business and the entertainment business are very good for charities. They always have been. From I was a kid in Casablanca, I remember Morris Lynch's band, we'd be playing for maybe the re-roofing of the church or something like that, or the almshouses. But yeah, when I came back to Dublin, I started doing charity work for St. Luke's Cancer Hospital. And we used to run a gig in the concert hall every year. And every year I put the arm on musicians. Different choirs came from all over Ireland, traditional musicians, jazz players, top singers, and they all came and did it. And when we did it for about 10 years, I think, and we raised over $250,000 for them.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was great.
It's
a wonderful satisfaction. I can still go out to St. Luke's. They have their Bluebell Day, and they what you call it, and people come along, and it's a thank you to people that look after them and all that. And there's still organisations like that are getting very tough now to get money, you know, because they
course.
Can't do their standing in Grafton Street with a box shaking it or whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
They can't do it. And
They'll all have to get the card machines, Paddy, because everyone's using cards.
I think
these
so.
Days.
And I still do a bit of work for Make-A-Wish.
Brilliant.
And we did a charity golf day last year, raised a lot of money, and a lot of great friends helped to support and organised it. And out in Powers Court, and we were to do it this year in August, but we had to call it off. Please God, we may be able to do it next year.
On Tuesday, the 15th of December, tell us, you're doing a lovely tribute show on TG Cahir to Brendan Boyer.
That's right. We recorded a tribute to Brendan. loads of people that knew him.
The Hucklebuck.
The Hucklebuck man, yeah. And yes, Brendan was a great, an icon of the Irish music industry, and so well loved, loved in Vegas. And I'm in touch with his family, with Stella, his wife, in Vegas all the time. And they miss him dreadfully, needless to say, because he died suddenly in the end, you know. He wasn't feeling well. We did the hospital, then it was heart failure at the end. But yeah, so T.G. Carr are doing a tribute to him. They're doing three tributes, and I think they're doing one to Jack Charlton, one to Larry Gogan, and the one to Brendan Byers is this Tuesday, the 15th. And a lot of us did it. We all had to go. It was during the lockdown, and we all had to go safe distance, whatever, and just say a few words and...
Ah, wonderful. I'm looking forward. I'll definitely be tuning into that. Yeah. Well, listen, Paddy, it has been an amazing pleasure having you on the show. And I can genuinely, unashamedly say, having been reading it myself, anyone who wants to give someone a cracking good read this Christmas, and it's on Amazon, Kindle, it's all over, it's everywhere.
Thanks very much.
King of the Swingers, I can highly recommend it. And it's been a great pleasure. Paddy, for Christmas now, I suppose a family Christmas.
Yeah, and this year we got a lovely phone call there from my son Pat and his wife Ger to say to Helen, see, my family are not coming home. Pierce and his wife Nikki and the family would have been coming home. Karen and Greg and all her family would have been coming home. So they're not coming home. Every year, traditionally, Helen did the turkey and did the whole lot. And we would have different people in for it. And Pierce would be home and all that. And Pierce's in-laws and all that. So we got the call the other day to say, don't buy a turkey. You're coming around to us to Pat for the Christmas.
Brilliant,
yeah,
brilliant.
So we're
brilliant.
Looking forward to that with the grandchildren and Pat and Jerry.
Fantastic. We'll all be Zooming all day
all
Christmas.
I never Zoomed as much as we like. Yeah.
Fantastic. Paddy, your last piece of music this evening is a great artist, yourself.
Joe Harrington will be slagging me now for playing myself.
I was listening to some of your music before, and Paddy, this is just absolutely beautiful. A Stranger on the Shore.
Yeah, and you know, I recorded that live for the Pat Kenny show when he was in RTE. And Chris Kennevy and Tommy Donoghue came in, Chris on keyboards, Tommy Donoghue on bass. And because Pat just said, would you play a piece maybe for us when you come in? And then he said we would. And we want to play an up-tempo jazz number or something. Pat said, you might do Stranger on the Shore. And we did it. And I hate listening to stuff I did myself. And you'd always find fault. But I think that turned out okay.
Oh, no, it's brilliant. And, sure, and people can tune in to you, of course, every Sunday here on Sunshine with your fabulous... You have a huge following in that show. Paddy, gurib míle maith agat agus nulach hona.
Gurib maith agat freisin. Gurib maith agat.